There is no greater economic lie than the idea that wealth is found in the ground. If natural resources determine prosperity, then Haiti would be richer than Hong Kong, and the Congo would be a superpower. But the evidence says otherwise. Switzerland has no oil, no gold, no diamonds, and yet it's one of the most advanced economies on Earth. Meanwhile, Venezuela, sitting on the world's largest proven oil reserves, has become a nation where people eat from garbage trucks. How is that possible? Because what determines prosperity is not what lies beneath your feet, but what lies between your ears. Culture, not oil, not aid, not geography, is what separates nations that flourish from nations that fail. As I've said before, if we learn anything from the history of economic development, it is that culture makes almost all the difference. And yet this is precisely the factor we're told to ignore. We're told poverty is caused by colonialism. That inequality is the legacy of slavery, that prosperity depends on redistribution or reparations or the latest initiative from the World Bank. But if these ideas had any merit, their results would speak for themselves. And they don't, because what actually produces wealth, sustained generational wealth, is not material but behavioral, not environmental but moral, not imposed from the outside but cultivated from within. Let's begin by asking the question that almost no one in academia is willing to ask. If poverty is the result of a lack of resources, then why has poverty been the universal condition of humanity for most of recorded history? There was no colonialism in the year 1000, no capitalism, no industrial revolution, and yet nearly all humans, regardless of continent or skin color, lived in abject poverty, that the average life expectancy was under 40. Infant mortality rates were staggering. Most people never traveled more than a few miles from where they were born. So if we're looking for a culprit behind poverty, we shouldn't be asking, why are some people poor? We should be asking, why is anyone rich? And the answer, again, is culture. Culture is not just music and food. Culture is the accumulated wisdom of generations passed down in the form of habits, institutions, values, and priorities. It is how knowledge is transmitted, how children are raised, how success is defined, and how failure is handled. In other words, culture is human capital. And over time, human capital is far more decisive than natural capital. Look at Japan. An island nation with no significant oil reserves, no massive deposits of iron or gold, and completely devastated by World War II, two of its cities flattened by atomic bombs. Yet by the 1980s, Japan had the second largest economy in the world. Was this a result of foreign aid? No. It was a result of cultural factors, a relentless work ethic, a national commitment to education, and an emphasis on social cohesion, discipline, and self-restraint. These are not natural resources. These are cultural resources. Now contrast that with Nigeria, one of the richest oil producers on the planet. And yet year after year, Nigeria ranks among the lowest in the world in infrastructure, literacy, life expectancy, and corruption perception. This is not about race. It is not about imperialism. It is not about international institutions holding Nigeria back. It is about culture. The Nigerian economy is plagued by tribalism, nepotism, and a short-term mentality where wealth is extracted, not created. A society that rewards power over productivity or favors over merit will never become prosperous, no matter how many resources it possesses. You're still not convinced that culture matters more than resources? Then consider immigration. If poverty were purely environmental or structural, then immigrants from poor countries would remain poor no matter where they went. But that's not what we see. Take Chinese immigrants to Southeast Asia. Many arrive dirt poor, banned from owning land, locked out of political power, and subject to violent discrimination. And yet within a generation, they dominated local commerce in countries like Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia. How? Because they brought with them a culture that prized thrift, hard work, family loyalty, and education. Those values didn't come from government grants. They came from tradition passed from parent to child over generations. Or take Jewish communities in Europe. In 19th century Hungary, Jews made up less than 10% of the population, but more than half of the nation's doctors and lawyers. The same pattern occurred in Poland, Germany, and later in the United States. These weren't societies that rolled out the red carpet. In fact, they were often hostile. But again, culture made the difference. Let me be clear. Culture is not genetic, it is not innate, and it is not immutable. But cultures can and do change. They evolve. You know, Japan transformed itself in the 19th century under the Meiji Restoration, abandoning centuries of feudal isolation in favor of modernization and industrialization. They adopted Western systems, not out of admiration, but out of necessity to survive and compete. Germany, after World War II, reinvented itself economically and politically, becoming one of the most prosperous democracies on earth. South Korea, once poorer than Ghana in the 1950s, became a global leader in technology, education, and industry within two generations. But none of these transformations happened by accident. They required cultural shifts, deliberate choices, often in direct opposition to the traditionalists and intellectuals of their day, who warned that these changes were inauthentic or Western imperialism. That is the irony. The same people who preach cultural relativism today, who insist all cultures are equally valid, end up promoting stagnation and poverty in the very communities they claim to protect. When you defend a culture of fatalism, corruption, or tribal violence as just different, you are not respecting that culture. You are entrenching its failures. So why do so many in academia and the media ignore culture? Because it is far easier to blame poverty on something external. If poverty is caused by capitalism, then we need socialism. If it's caused by colonialism, then we need reparations. If it's caused by systemic racism, then we need redistribution. In each case, the solution is simple. Shift the blame and the money away from the individual or the community and on to society at large. But when you say poverty is caused by culture, the solution becomes more difficult because culture cannot be redistributed. It must be taught and reinforced and sustained, often in defiance of the loudest voices in elite institutions. Culture is not created in government offices. It is created in homes, churches, classrooms, and neighborhoods. But those are the very places that modern intellectuals have spent decades undermining. In The Vision of the Anointed, I describe a prevailing mindset among intellectuals, a belief that societal disparities are solely the result of external forces and that all cultures are equally valid and beyond critique. This perspective dismisses the idea that internal norms and behaviors might influence outcomes, labeling such suggestions as racist or insensitive. However, this refusal to consider cultural factors leaves individuals powerless, waiting for systemic changes rather than taking control of their circumstance. Over the decades, billions have been poured into foreign aid with the assumption that poverty stems from a lack of resources. Yet these initiatives often neglect the cultural factors that determine how resources are utilized. In Wealth, Poverty, and Politics, I discuss how aid can be squandered in societies where corruption is rampant and where short-term gains are prioritized over long-term development. Without a cultural framework that supports accountability and hard work, external assistance does little to foster genuine progress. Intellectuals often promote cultural relativism, the idea that all cultures are equally valid and should not be judged. While this may seem tolerant, it can be detrimental. By refusing to acknowledge the shortcomings of certain cultural practices, we hinder societies from self-reflection and evolution. In The Vision of the Anointed, I critique this mindset, emphasizing that shielding cultures from criticism under the guise of respect can perpetuate harmful traditions and impede progress. Cultures are not static, they evolve over time. Societal advancement lies in the willingness to adopt beneficial practices and discard detrimental ones. Post-Meiji Japan is a prime example. Faced with the threat of Western imperialism, Japanese leaders embraced Western technologies and institutional reforms while retaining core aspects of their cultural identity. This adaptability propelled Japan into the ranks of the world's leading economy. Conversely, societies that resist change or cling to counterproductive traditions often find themselves mired in stagnation. Recognizing the need for cultural introspection and reform is essential for any society aiming to achieve sustained prosperity. Now, let me clarify something that too many people get wrong. Culture is not passed on through DNA. It is passed on through example, through instruction, through reinforcement, by parents, teachers, peers, and institutions, what children see growing up, their attitudes toward time, work, honesty, and responsibility is far more predictive of their outcomes than how many minerals lie beneath their country's soil. This is why we can see profound differences, even within the same ethnic group, depending on where they live and what cultural patterns they adopt. People talk about privilege and oppression as if these are the primary determinants of success. But when you actually look at the data, and I mean really look, you find something very different. You can see it in the experience of Chinese immigrants across Southeast Asia. You can see it in Jewish immigrants in Eastern Europe. You can see it in Japanese Americans after World War II. These were not privileged people. These were not groups lavished with resources or political power, but they brought with them cultural patterns that promoted advancement. And that made all the difference. But intellectuals in society, I warned about the undue influence of people whose only product is ideas, often bad ideas, with no consequences for being wrong. One of their worst ideas is that any criticism of culture is inherently oppressive or racist. This shields dysfunctional norms from scrutiny while smearing anyone who dares ask the hard questions. These are the same people who elevate grievance above achievement, who treat envy as insight, and who think you can build a thriving society on nothing but historical resentment and redistribution schemes. But history has shown time and again that no amount of money, policy, or apology can substitute for the hard work of cultural development. Another destructive notion that's gained currency is the idea of cultural relativism, that all cultures are equally valid, equally worthy, and equally conducive to success. That may sound noble, but it's an idea without a shred of evidence to back it up. If culture made no difference, then Somali immigrants in the U.S. would have the same outcomes as Indian or Nigerian immigrants. But they don't. The disparities are vast, economically, educationally, and socially. Now, is that because of racism? Or is it because not all cultural practices are equally beneficial? Some cultures emphasize punctuality, others do not. Some cultures prioritize literacy and math, others do not. Some cultures teach deference to law and order, others glorify defiance. These differences matter. They are not superficial. They shape lives and destinies. Treating all cultures as interchangeable is not respect, it's negligence. It prevents people from making the changes necessary to succeed in the real world, not just in university seminars. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Culture isn't just about food, festivals, or language. Culture is about values, what a society prizes, encourages, and expects. Do people save for the future? Do they invest in their children's education? Do they respect contracts, the rule of law, and other people's property? Or do they embrace instant gratification, see theft as legitimate redistribution, and dismiss academic excellence as acting white? You can see the consequences of these choices around the world. In Wealth, Poverty, and Politics, I discuss how cultural norms that support thrift, investment, and hard work tend to create long-term prosperity. The opposite norms tend to destroy it. Politicians and international organizations love to sell the idea that poor countries can be lifted up with enough foreign aid. But what they refuse to admit is this: no amount of money can overcome a culture that squanders it. Billions have been poured into sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and parts of Asia. The results, in many cases, no better than before, and in some cases, worse. Why? Because without the cultural foundations for accountability, honesty, and long-term thinking, money disappears. It goes into private accounts, white elephant projects, or unproductive subsidies. Foreign aid can't teach discipline. It can't impose a sense of obligation, and it can't create the cultural capital that ultimately determines whether a society flourishes or fails. When you say culture matters, people often respond, well, how do we fix it? As if there were a 5-point government program to replace cultural values. But the culture isn't changed from the top down. It's changed from the inside out. It starts in homes where children learn or fail to learn self-control, honesty, and perseverance. It continues in schools that demand excellence instead of making excuses, in churches that promote moral discipline, in communities that celebrate achievement instead of envy. These are not tasks for bureaucrats. They are responsibilities that belong to families, neighborhoods, and voluntary institutions. The danger of denying the importance of culture is not just theoretical. It is tragically real. When we tell struggling communities that their problems are all external, that it's racism or capitalism or colonization, we strip them of agency. We teach helplessness. We create a psychology of dependence rather than one of responsibility. And in doing so, we perpetuate the very conditions we claim to oppose. This is why I have consistently opposed policies based on group victimhood rather than individual accountability. It's not because I deny history. It's because I've seen what happens when you build identity around grievance instead of capacity. You get anger, yes. You get demands. You get slogans and protests. You don't get progress. It takes courage to say that. It takes honesty. And it takes a willingness to defy the elites who tell you that self-examination is betrayal. But in the long run, that's the only way forward. In sum, the disparities among nations and communities are not solely the result of external factors like colonialism or access to resources. They are deeply rooted in cultural values, norms, and behaviors. Acknowledging the pivotal role of culture does not mean dismissing historical injustices. Rather, it underscores the importance of internal transformation as a catalyst for progress. The truth is not always comfortable, especially in an age where blame is currency and victimhood is virtue. But the truth remains, what lies between our ears matters more than what lies beneath our feet. That may not fit into a 30-second soundbite or a trending hashtag, but has built civilization and has destroyed them when forgotten, as I have stated. If we learn anything from the history of economic development, it is that culture makes almost all the difference. By fostering cultures that value education, hard work, and innovation, societies can chart a path toward lasting prosperity, regardless of their starting point.